examples on the topic in terms of, you know, aging, sickness, death, what next. So that that meditation was just to sort of introduce the idea of we have a mind that has previous moment, going back, lifetime to lifetime, and that same mind going forward once we leave this body behind. And it was what, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha, when he sat under the Bodhi tree, or what was a pipal tree, but now called Bodhi tree, Bodhi, awake, and so sat there and said, I will not get up until I attain enlightenment. And the story is told that in the first quarter of the evening, of the night, that Shakyamuni Buddha saw his own past lives. In the second quarter, he saw the past lives of others. In the third quarter, he overcame all the disturbing emotions, all the afflictions of the mind, all the mental afflictions, and then at daybreak became enlightened. So that's how it goes. So the benefit of being able to, first of all, recall our own life, and I don't know about you, how well you do, but you know, I find it very difficult to reflect back to this morning. I think, okay, this morning, now what was I doing? Okay, and, you know. That's fairly easy. But once I go back a week, a month, a year, all I know is, yeah, I felt different, but not so precise. But training our mind gradually to recall. It's what you do when you study. You're training your mind to recall things so that when you have an exam, you remember them, right? Or you're swatting at the last minute. Anyway, either way, you're still recalling. Doing both. Still recalling. So this idea of the continuity of the mind going from life to life to life, and certainly the examples that we see with, I see in my tradition with the lamas, like the Dalai Lama, you know, when Dalai Lama number 13 passed away, and they started checking with the next Dalai Lama, and so they, anyway, found this child and put the child or children that they find and test them out with various tests. And this one, the Dalai Lama, chose, they put out malas and bells and things that belonged to the previous Dalai Lama, all mixed up with other things that didn't belong to the previous Dalai Lama. But the child picks, you know, and says, oh, this is mine. And they even, in the Dalai Lama case, they dressed up the teacher to look like the servant and the servant to look like the teacher, and he went to the servant and talked to him because he realized it was his teacher. So many, many tests like that, until they're absolutely convinced. And the only thing that can convince them is that this mind was the being that was called the previous Dalai Lama. It was the same mind or mental continuum going from that being to that being. So the body left behind, not the same body, not the same personality, not the same person, but very subtle level of mind. So that's the idea. So we can see it in people like Dalai Lama or other lamas like that. And also there's been a lot of past lives research done, and particularly some young children who are not of any particular religious belief or anything like that, but can remember from their past life. And maybe they're born into a family. They did some kids in like Poland and South America, all sorts of places. And I remember there was one kid who was born into this village, and he kept saying, they're my parents. And he actually, his parents of this life allowed him to go and live with those parents until about the age of 7. It sort of seems to all disappear, but it's sort of like haven't quite moved into this life from a previous life, and the previous life is more real. But then gradually things of this life become more real, and they sort of forget that. Interesting study. Not having either of those experiences myself, but having experienced things like, you know, the deja vu, that feeling, I've been here before, I've seen you before, or so forth. So we all have a level of clairvoyance. If anyone training to be an architect, you are an architect, you're not training, you are an architect. So you can visualize what this building would be like before it was built. Me, I saw a concrete mess. But you saw, you could see. So you, as an architect, you make designs and you can see what something's going to be like in the future, or a landscape gardener, all of this. We all have the skill to project into the future what something's really going to look like. And it follows specifications and everything else, that's what it would look like. So we all have a clairvoyance. It's not something that is, you know, just these people who run around doing shows and get a lot of money for, I can read your mind. So we've all got this skill and we just develop it more and more and more. So so this is the idea of going from life to life to life. And, you know, the idea of rebirth can be very, very difficult to feel that there's any evidence of. You say, well, you know, maybe not. And it's not just in Buddhism. If you look at the stories of, like, Jesus Christ arising from the dead, you know, we had this sort of reincarnate life and somehow it didn't last long. I don't know. I can't remember the rest of the story, but so it wasn't like he stayed around. But to say, you know, there are many Buddhas alive in the world today in many different forms, because the Buddha made a vow to always speak in language that would, you know, be suitable to the beings. So, you know, whether it's in the form of a dog or whether it's in the form of a human, and then speaking different languages and so forth. And the very first students of the Buddha all went out in different directions, and we have all these different traditions. There's all the teachings of the Buddha, but they all heard slightly differently. Not everything's compatible, but they heard more emphasis on this or more emphasis on that. And so, because we've all got different minds, we need all of this. The Buddha said there's 84,000 paths. I can't name them, but I believe them. And so there's many, many different ways and beliefs that go along with it. So the main thing is that, you know, sort of in making meaning of this life, that we think about death all the time. And then people say, oh, you're a Buddhist, so morbid, like you talk about death all the time, suffering. It's a reality. We are going to die. Even Shakyamuni Buddha left the body behind. We will all leave this body behind. So in the time of death, this body's not going to help you. Family and friends are not going to help you. You know, we die alone. We're born alone, we die alone. Probably when you're born, you don't think you're so alone because mum's there and, you know, there's nurses and doctors, hopefully, and family and whatever. but anyway, we do come in alone and we die alone. We can't take our career, our wealth, our possessions. Although the Egyptians used to put a lot of, I don't know, maybe other cultures as well, a lot of their worldly possessions in the grave and so forth. There is that tradition, but it stays in the ground. It doesn't pass into another life. But what we do take is our mind and all the imprints that are on that mind. So one of the things is being aware of familiarising ourselves with the process of death. It's the same process we go through when we go to sleep. We actually go through, like, the stages of death, but we don't die. But the settling of all the elements in the body, you know, the earth element, water element, fire element, and air element happens as we go to sleep. So often we're asked, you know, just as you're going to sleep, see if you can be aware of the different stages and take some training, because I go, I'm awake, I'm asleep. But, and then you go into a dream state, and that's like, it's like it's part of the death state where you're leaving the body and going into some other experience. And some people talk about astral travelling or leaving their body and so forth. But I've been very fortunate that, well, my mother may not agree, but she has had two times she's been clinically dead. And after the second time, about 10 years later, I started to quiz her about, you know, just go through it, what it felt like at the time, you know, what do you remember? And she remembers this white light. She remembers it was a very blissful, peaceful experience. And so this is what we would call, like, this fifth stage of death. This stage of death. Where it is, it's described as being very blissful, it's a dream-like quality. Anyway, so, and that's the stage where people who suffer, who experience near death, up to that stage, you can come back. So people talk about being in operating theatres and actually in one operating theatre, they drew symbols on the top of really high cupboards, so people being operated on down here. And they thought, "Oh, I'm a doctor." Training to in the medical. You could test it out. Anyway, the person's there having the operation, and then they talk about the near-death experience, and they will describe what was on top of the cupboard, which they couldn't have seen from where they were lying. So. Anyway, so that people's bodies do actually leave, come back. So my mother talks about death not as a final thing. We make death as something final. And my mother says it's another step in the journey. I guess because she's done it a couple of times in this body, she's not. She says I'm not at all afraid. And I hope that sticks at the time of actual death. But she's not at all afraid. It's just another step in the journey, and that's very much what the Buddha was talking about. It is just another step in the journey. The mind continues on, so it's like doing as much as we can in this life to develop the positive qualities of mind to benefit others and so forth. So that we have the best possible rebirth in which to carry on that work, to keep going. And obviously, everyone here has done that in previous lifetimes, because one, to have a human rebirth is rare, to have what they call, what is called a precious human rebirth. It's not only human, but you're here and not at the pub. You're interested in Buddhism, you perhaps have a Buddhist practice. So a spiritual life is more meaningful to you than maybe a material life, or maybe a little bit of conflict between the two, or not quite so balanced. So you have that, and you have it available. You're in a country where you have the availability of the Dharma. Not all countries do, even in my tradition, Tibet these days, very hard for a lot of Tibetans. But in many countries, you were stuck in a war zone, you're not going to be, you're probably going to be thinking, how do I stay alive right now, and how do I protect my family and keep them alive? So we're in a fairly peaceful country, quite peaceful country. We have all these opportunities available to us. You know, there's racism, there's this, that and the other thing, but pretty peaceful by and large. So this would say that you have a precious human rebirth, which means that you have created the conditions to be here from your past life. From your virtue, from your moral discipline, from your generosity, and so forth, patience, etc. So we don't underestimate what we have, and then on top of that, say, okay, how can I make the most of this stuff? How can I do the most to continue this? And that's where karma comes into it. Positive reaps positive, negative reaps negative. So the more virtue we engage in, the more virtue we experience, and the more non-virtue we engage in, the more non-virtue that we experience, put simply. And at the time of death, obviously we want our mind in the most virtuous state. So a couple of years ago my father died, and actually 2 years ago today, I just realised it was the 13th of May, next week, I'll be prepared next week. 2 years ago next week, and on the day that he died, I was with him for most of the day, and then after he passed away, and my father was Catholic, but in the sort of last years of his life, first of all he said, "Oh, I want Buddhist prayers." I said, "Oh, really? Why do you want Buddhist prayers?" And then he wanted Catholic prayers, and then he didn't want any prayers, and I was like, very confusing. But what you try and do is for someone at the time of death is to put whatever's going to make their mind most comfortable and in a happy state to provide that. The worst thing we can do is say, "Don't go, don't leave me, which is maybe what we want to do. But that keeps them attached to this life and this body, and the sense of attachment is one of the worst things that you can have at the time of death. So when my father was dying, and I think even my brothers, everyone, my mother, saying, "It's okay, you can let go, it's fine, we're all good, you don't have to worry about anyone, anything, just be peaceful, and let go." And so he was surrounded by that, and then during the night, he was saying prayers all night. Me and one of my brothers, who's Catholic, stayed all night, and made sure the nurses didn't touch him for as long as possible, that he wasn't touched, so that, you know, the consciousness can come out. The higher up in the body, the bit higher rebirth, so come out through the crown of the head, just sort of tugging on his head. One hair sticking up here. It was pretty bald. I realised how tough the hair was, actually. I thought it would come out in my hand, and it didn't. Anyway, it was just sort of a reminder, come out through here. I have no idea. My clairvoyance is like, I said, we all have clairvoyance. Mine's pretty non-existent along those lines, but at least trying to create the conditions for the best possible rebirth. So, you know, good evening. So anyway, when my mother dies, hopefully I'll be there too and say her Catholic prayers if she's still wanting to. So for ourselves, so both for ourselves, practicing familiarity with and the process of death now while we can, because we don't know when we're going to die. I wouldn't like to see it happen, but any of us, any moment, you know, the next breath, you breathe out and don't breathe in again, it can happen when we least expect it. So the time of death is uncertain. We have no guarantee of when we're going to die. Having said that, recently, in October last year, one of the things I do is I look after this prison project, Liberation Prison Project, and that's men and women who are in prison who realise what they've done has got them into prison, and they really want to do something a bit differently and use the time in prison to turn their lives around. And then those that are interested in Buddhism get in touch and say, I want to learn to meditate, I want to learn about Buddhist teachings. Even they're not Buddhist or whatever, it doesn't matter, they want to be interested. And anyway, this one guy, and he'd been in prison for murder. He was on death row in Oklahoma, in the States. So, and he'd been in prison about 10 years, and for at least half of that time, he'd really got very interested in Dharma practice and was doing amazing practices and also helping others in the prison around him, because they could see change in him and they were interested in what he was doing. And so he was. So he had wanted to sort of continue being alive so that he could learn more and more Dharma and actually teach the Dharma. That's what he really wanted to do. But he had this death sentence, and he had every appeal possible, everything you could possibly do, and every appeal was knocked back. And he was in a prison. There was another guy on death row with him who was supposed to die before him, who had a date in August. And then they used three drugs, and one of the drugs they ran out, it was in short supply throughout the states altogether, and a lot of executions were put off. You're supposed to have enough of this drug for two executions, even if you're doing one execution, because if it goes wrong, you've got to have a backup. Anyway, so I know it's a gruesome thing, and what's more, this is like a sedative, and the drug company that never imagined it was going to be used for execution, so they were sort of holding back supply. So in many states, people's death sentence was put off. So this guy who was supposed to die before him, his appointment with death was put off, or to a hearing that was going to be after this date in October, when our guy was scheduled for death on October the 13th last year. So. So nothing in terms of, you know, the judicial system helped him. He had a Buddhist lawyer, and she not necessarily because she was Buddhist, but she spoke about how the transformation he'd made and the benefit he wanted to contribute. He reconciled with his family. They all said he's completely changed. He always claimed that he was innocent and that he'd been framed by his ex-wife. It was her and her brother who committed the murder, but nonetheless, here he was, and there was nothing going to save him from this death. Nothing. And so in the past, in the last week of his life, last 2 weeks of his life, he had a lama with him. He had the person who'd been corresponding with him, his spiritual guide, teacher, and he was just doing prayers and practices the whole time. He planned that at the time of his execution that he would that you get 2 minutes, you get a final speech, 2 minute speech, and so he vowed that during that he would pray for all beings for release from suffering, and that he would say mantras and so forth. And so at the time of his death, that is what he did until he lost consciousness. And his support, his teachers and the lama were there, and they have an observation chamber where you can watch. And the door was a little bit open from between the observation chamber and the death chamber. And so this Geshe, this lama, he was yelling mantras at him, like out loud, it was sort of so he would hear really loudly. And afterwards he said, "None of us will be as prepared for death as he was." None of us, because he had this date, he prepared for it, he knew what he was doing, going to do at the time. I mean, are we going to be able to do that? Likelihood is pretty low. You know, we all like to think we're going to die of old age gradually. And even friends of mine have been in hospital, they say, practice now, because at the time, you know, when you're really ill, you might know it yourself already if you've been really ill. It's really hard to practice at that time when you're really ill. So, anyway, he had one of the worst situations you could say from a worldly point of view. He was executed, but from a spiritual point of view, he would have died in a very peaceful state and a very virtuous state, praying for others for the benefit of all other beings. And so maybe he will get his wish, maybe he will be reborn and become a great teacher, who knows. But he certainly did everything he could once he met the Dharma to create the best possible opportunity for that to happen. So I like that story. Very cool. So in the teachings it says, if a person who's normally non-virtuous, as you could say this guy was, normally non-virtuous, up until 5 years, the last 5 years of his life, you know, up until 35 or whatever, but if they die in a state of virtue, then they're more likely to have a virtuous life next time. So even though we've got this karma that we've accumulated, that he would have accumulated very negative karma, and it doesn't get worse than killing someone. You create the cause for a short life, you create the cause to be killed yourself, you create the cause to have chronic illness and so forth by that. But nonetheless, at the time of death, it's so important what state of our mind, because that determines your next rebirth. That determines what life, and there's a sense that going into the next life, there is a sense of your karma, throwing karma, as it's called, the karma for your next birth, determines also the length of your birth, the length of your life. And then people who suffer untimely death, he's probably one of them, where by other circumstances your death is shortened. So not living out your natural life becomes shortened by other things that happen. So that you could say he directly created the cause himself, he murdered one. On the contrary, we've got this guy in Western Australia, did you hear, the World War I veteran? 110 years old, he died yesterday. Did you hear about that? 110. You can say that's a long life. By any standards, it's a long life. So you could say he had created great merit to have a long life. So through engaging in positive activities, we can extend our life, have a long life. Because why? If we want to have a long life as possible, if we want to be of benefit to others, we want to be able to maximise that possibility as much as we can. So, important to remember that one, death is certain. We will die. We will die. We don't know when. And when we do, the only thing that's going to help us is our Dharma practice. The only thing that's going to help at the time is if they say, you know, when you're dying, remember, you know, to call out the name of the Buddha, remember to say mantras, remember, if you can do any of those things, fantastic. You know, anything, just calling to mind an image of the Buddha, anything that has our mind in a virtual state, if we can do any of that, hopefully we've got enough of an inkling that we're dying to be able to do that. Good luck. The only way we're going to do that is practice now, so it's always in your mind anyway, so whether you're alive or whether you're dead, it's there. It's really the only way we can do it. Another friend of mine who died a few years ago, so he wasn't Buddhist. Not that that matters, you know, as I said, you know, Dalai Lama says, practice kindness, my religion's kindness. It's the label Buddhist, the label any religion, whatever is going to help you on your spiritual journey, make meaning of your life. So anyway, he did have a spiritual practice, it wasn't a particular religion, and he had a cancer, a very aggressive cancer, and so he was given like about 5 months to live, and he decided not to have chemo and go down that route because it might extend his life by a month or two or three, but he'd be sick the whole time. And so he thought, well, quantity of life. So he decided not to go down that track and took painkillers. And what was interesting to me was, you know, here I thought there was someone who would deal with death in a very spiritual way, because he had a spiritual practice and so forth. He did not at all. He went into complete denial. He kept working up to the very last minute. He didn't sort out any of his affairs. You know, he's American, he was living in America, his wife's Australian, and there was a whole mess about the house and the finances, and he didn't want to deal with any of it and so forth, so she was left with that all afterwards, and he just completely ignored the fact that he was dying, and next minute he was dead. So we never know how we're going to be at the time of death. The only way we're going to know that is now, putting in the hard yards and, you know, sort of keeping our mind in a positive state as much as possible, so that it will just be natural to us. It's sort of like you go to your default mode, so whatever your default mode is, that's going to be it, you know. So so then the other side is looking, reminding ourselves that, you know, just like our body's impermanent, just like this life is impermanent, that everything is impermanent. Everything around us is impermanent. So not getting shocked when, you know, relationships break up or favourite television show gets axed. Changes to a night when you can't watch it, so forth. There's constant change, impermanence, and so if we can allow our minds to be fluid enough to deal with impermanence and the fact that there is going to be constant change, that nothing is going to stay the same, including having a body, having this life, then our minds are in a more harmonious state. I was hearing today, I don't know if this is true, because I haven't seen it, but at the Easter show, did anyone go to the Easter show? Someone went? Were you working there?
No.
They've got this thing called Psycho Sideshow. Yeah, they think I didn't go there. Yeah, I wouldn't either with a name like that. But anyway, there's this guy who swallows a sword. Apparently it's not a fake sword. Apparently it's not one of those collapsible up ones that just look like he's swallowing a sword. He actually swallows it. And then he's got a microphone down here and it pops this balloon to prove, like, inside his belly. And what they say is he uses his mind to split his organs, to, like, split things apart. And I don't know if it's true. I want to see an x-ray of the whole thing. But if he does, he's got amazing mind over matter. He's got amazing control of his mind. He can actually separate out the organs and pop a balloon in his belly, the tip of the sword. I don't know, I can just see blood. Perhaps I haven't got vivid enough imagination, but anyway, it is, you know, we can actually, there are amazing feats that are achievable. You know, Aboriginal people in Central Australia, that I do know, I have seen, that their sense of sound, their sense of sight isn't, I mean, my sight's appalling anyway, but is way beyond anything in my imagination. You know, going out with the women and they're tapping the ground and they say, dig there, because the you know, roots of the acacia tree is the witch grub. And so they tap, and if they can hear the echo of a rotten root, not with their ear to the ground, their ear here, just tapping, and they know where to dig, and that's where they're, and it's true enough, they're there. So they're very, it's not, they're not miracle makers, they've just got very fine hearing, a sort of survival mechanism. You have to develop that. And we went, these guys in a van, and they said, look at the berries over on the bush, and I'm going, where's the bush? So we have amazing, we restrict our own selves, and maybe the guy with the sword is really doing that, you know, because we think, oh, you know, couldn't possibly have that much control. Anyway, so is there any questions at this point? Or any comments you have, any experiences that you have that you can throw into the account? Anyone want to say anything? Yes.
My name is Jean Lee.
Yes. Yes. Yes, I've heard that one. Yes. Yes. The power. Yeah. Power is a practice that you do where you have control to shoot your consciousness out through the top of your head. So you practice, that is a practice that people do. Yeah. So that then again, that is a practice. And if people have control over that, then you can even transfer somebody else's consciousness at the time of death. So it's a very powerful practice, and I've only practiced the sort of baby stages. So go, because if you get it wrong, your consciousness is out there and not in here. It's quite hard, yeah. But yes, that is one practice, it's a power practice, and that's for the time of death. But on a more sort of, I guess, mundane level, or more, we do prayers for people at the time of death. And the idea, and you can debate if you like, but the idea, the Buddha, is that we go, after we leave this life and we go into this bardo state, and I know all traditions don't necessarily follow this, we go into a bardo state, which is like an intermediate state, which is said to be like a dream state, like when we go into a dream, it's like when we go from this life into this bardo state, a dream state where your senses are all intact, you don't have a body. Anyway, you're in that state for up to 49 days, in groups of 7 days. And they say after every 7 days, it's sort of like you have like a mini death. If you haven't already found a new form for your next birth, then you go into another, a second intermediate stage, and a third and fourth up to 7. So we pray for people in this period of 49 days. And so when you're in that state, it says that you go towards the familiar. You know, it's like you get propelled towards something that is familiar. So, you know, you might have familiarity from this life towards, you know, parents of this life or whatever, and then you go towards that, and then if it's you're going into a human rebirth, you go towards a couple that are having sex, and let's say if you're going to take male form, you get attached to the female. If you're going to take female form, you get attached to the male. But in this way, I don't know, just read about it. Anyway, so you've got these 49 days where we do prayers and practices for people to attain the best possible rebirth. And I don't know what happens in the bardo state. It's a very subtle level of mind, this continuum of mind. But there have been many experiments done on people praying for people and the benefit of prayer, so that even if you don't know you're being prayed for, that the people experience a benefit of that, you know. So I guess it makes sense, because it's like you're putting out a positive energy in the environment and it has to be of benefit. So so in our tradition we do like Medicine Buddha, which is a healing Buddha practice, or any of the long life, like my spiritual director of our organisation worldwide, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, he had a stroke last week. We were in retreat with him in Bendigo, and he ended up in hospital, and then we got asked to do all these prayers and practices, which we did constantly for the week and so forth, and maybe it's his way of making us practice hard. Say, good, I finally got the practice in. I don't know. But there's certainly something about the power of prayer generally. I mean, we can feel it for ourselves, you know. I certainly know when I'm doing a lot of mantras, it's sort of like it's beneficial inwardly, and then hopefully it's having some benefit in the environment. You know, I went to this teaching with Dalai Lama in India some years ago, and I always forget what the equivalent of the premier of the state, the first leader, whatever he's called. Anyway, he spoke at this gathering, and he said 100,000 people saying mantras and prayers has got to change the environment, like it's from the physical environment, in the space we were. So, I guess we were people who are conscious of the environment, maybe we were a bit careful. So, any other questions or comments arising? Experience you want to share?
I remember my mom.
Yes.
She's not fine.
Yes.
Because she keeps seeing all my other uncles and granduncles. Yeah, they see that they're old.
Yeah.
And she always says that I'd rather die early, peacefully.
Yes.
Rather than getting old and then getting sick, and so you have to take care of the other people, and then you create troubles for other people. So, because I heard you saying that it's better to get a long life. And
yeah.
But I just suddenly remember what she says. She would rather die early and peacefully. And she's old, and then she's in sickness.
Yeah.
And she's in suffering for even a longer time.
Yeah. So it depends. I mean, when I say it's better to have a longer life, it depends what you're doing with that life, too. And so, if she has some spiritual meaning to that life, and then it's like if you're following a Buddhist practice, so forth, or any other spiritual practice, it gives you time to do more practice. If that's what you're engaging in, or you know, even when you can't physically be of benefit to each other, to others, and you know, a friend of mine who's not so old, and she's pretty much bedridden the whole time, and she has all these chronic illness and so forth, and says to me, well, what good is my life? You know, I can hardly get out of bed. But she's a very loving, caring person, and there's a lot of people in her life who would very much miss her if she left this life early, and she can talk to people on the phone and all of this sort of thing. So it's not completely a waste. It may not be what she wants to be doing, So my mother's similar to your mother. Says, you know, I don't want to be a burden on people and so forth and so forth. And I keep reminding her that you have a very good mind. So I guess in Buddhism we pay more attention to the mental state, really, than to the physical. I mean, we look after our body as much as we can, but what we develop is our mind. So that, you know, I mean, I'd say that to my mother, and I think, well, I don't know if it's going to make a difference to her or not. And then, you know, I can just remind her of her positive qualities. qualities, which, you know, I'm not making it up, and she has wonderful positive qualities, and a lot of people who rely on her too, you know, they don't rely on her to drive her somewhere or do shopping, but companionship, friendship, advice and so forth. So you could, you know, maybe just remind your mother of how she's, all the people that she benefits, and without being fearful that she's going to suddenly, you know, when the time will come. But I think it's something that our society promotes this thing, and it particularly, you know, I mean, I think in Asian cultures much more accepted. I'm right, right? I mean, that there's more value for the people of their age and the wisdom of their elderly and so forth. Whereas growing up in a, you know, Anglo-Australian culture, it's sort of like we don't very much respect, you know, the elders, our elders. In many cultures, it's a great respect for elders and looking, and a custom of looking after and caring for that's accepted. That may be changing too, I don't know, but certainly, you know, it's just like we don't realise. I mean, these are the people who've lived through so much, have so much wisdom, and, you know, done so many things that they can reflect back on and think, well, maybe I didn't do that so well, and maybe I can prevent you from doing that, or at least advise you not to do it the way I did it, or, you know, there's so much wisdom that can be shared. And so this is the thing. I mean, I pray to have a longer life so that I can work on my mind as much as possible to guarantee that I have the best opportunity for a better rebirth and, you know, be able to continue to practice and so forth. That's my motivation. And it was like this guy who died. His motivation, he didn't care to die for himself. You know, the one who was executed. It wasn't like, I'm scared of death, most people, and the lawyer said this, most people that she had defended, because she defended a lot of people who were executed, or were up for execution, I think only a couple got off. And she said, most of them want to stay alive because they're afraid of death. He was not afraid of death. He wanted to stay alive because now he had something to contribute to society. So now he wanted to be able to do what he hadn't done. He felt he'd wasted so many years of his life. So we don't want to get to that point. You know, my life's been a waste of time. I'm sure my mother's hasn't been a waste of time. So sometimes need a reminder. You say, it's only the physical body that's giving up. Your mind's fine. You know, the physical body is saying, yes, you need to rest, because you do, it's exhausted.
I think you need a certain level of practice so that, you know, your mind is not easily influenced by your physical condition. Because for, I think, for a lot of people,
Yeah.
The mind is not strong enough, you know, to stay calm and peaceful when the body is not ready.
Well, like I said about illness, it is harder. Starting older, but Alan Wallace, who's a great meditator, shamatha, calm abiding practitioner. And one time he was going to do a retreat, a long term retreat, or maybe a 6 month retreat anyway, not long term, but 6 months. And he hired a cabin from this little old lady up in the mountains. And she said, oh, before you go onto this retreat, show me how to meditate. So she was elderly already. And so he did. Then he went up, and then when he came back, he saw this youthful, joyful little old lady. And she said, I feel fantastic. I've been meditating every day for 5 hours or whatever. I mean, she could. She had that time in her life. She had never meditated before. And so she'd done that, and she said, you know, I had to, every week she'd get together with her, all her friends, they'd get together. She said, I had to stop going, because every time I went, they're talking about this ache and that pain, and what else is going wrong with their body, and I was feeling better and better, and they're telling me what's wrong, and she said, I had to stop going, I had nothing to complain about. So you're never too old. But it's that wanting to, you know, it's that desire to, and that's individual. Mm. That's really up to us all. So maybe she's interested, maybe she's not. Yeah. And maybe try to show some little video clips or something that you think she might be interested in. My sister actually was the last person in the world I thought would be interested in Buddhism, and once she came to stay with me, she went into my bedroom and said, "Come in here." Uh oh, she's my older sister, Bossy. Everything's Bossy. "Come in here." I went, "Oh no, she's going to stay." And she just wanted to know all about, I had an altar and this and that, and what's this and what's that. And she was interested. And I sent her a book on, I thought, okay, I won't send it to anything that she's got to read a lot of words. I sent her something with a lot of pictures, coffee table book. So I sent her one of those and for Christmas. And she didn't wait till Christmas. She opened it up straight away and she rang me and said, "Ah, fantastic. I was just about to, throw the husband out and hit the kids." And I had a cup of tea, sat down and read the book. And this year, she just rang me last night and she said, "I do want to go to that talk with the Dalai Lama, and I want to go and volunteer for the Dalai Lama." Who knows? I wouldn't have expected. I certainly didn't ever raise the topic from my side. And,
I would like to hear your opinion on this. When my grandmother died, she was in coma for several weeks, almost a month. And my mother was actually sitting by her side, so she's not alone.
Yeah.
And during the coma, you could see that the body of my grandmother was deteriorating more and more.
Yeah.
And because my mother was there almost 24 hours every day, sometimes she was hearing not voices, but they were singing, like let it go come to us. And she was not sure if she was kind of hallucinating or if it was like a lack of sleep or something like that. But actually she felt like, why is she not leaving the body? Why is she not dying? Like it was like she was artificially paralyzed, like she had kidney failure. And so my mother was actually wondering, why am I not going? So almost every night she heard like these voices.
Who heard it? The one in the car. Your mother heard.
Yeah, my mother heard it. But my grandmother was fine. Until she actually left, basically, or until she really died, and then the voice was not true. And so my mother was not sure if it was just a lack of sleep thing or
could have been.
Did you hear something about that?
No.
Did other people hear voices, but that's the next 5 hours like that?
No.
Okay,
I mean, my mother, like, maybe a year after my father passed away, said, your father came and talked to me, and so forth. And I'm not going to say that probably he didn't, because actually he's left that body a long time ago, and now he's probably in some other body. They just said, fuck. Because it was her belief, that happened. And maybe some consolation to her or something. So it might have been something like that with your mother. It's not something that you would hear in the teachings. Of course, we say there are spirits around, but. Maybe. I don't know. From your mother's side. Because all our experiences really are a product of our mind. Certainly a person dying, and a person in a state like that, in coma, have a very subtle level of mind. So actually, in that state, even though someone's in a coma, if you still did their, played the music that they liked, or, something comforting that they'd like to hear, that it's the subtle level of consciousness would connect with that, because they're still there in the body. They haven't left. But we think because they're comatose, they can't hear anything or experience anything. But I think there have been studies of that too that people have. So it also means that they're very, you don't have conversations about after they died in front of them when they're in a comatose state or anything like that, because they would be connected with all of that. And because it's a very subtle level of consciousness, they pick up on just very subtle feelings and all sorts of things. But from your mother's side, I don't know. And if she was very in tune with your grandmother, maybe.
No.
Yeah. That's up to, yeah. So, So then the importance, you know, the benefits of meditating on death and the fact that we're going to die, apart from familiarizing ourselves with it, is that all our actions become beneficial, because it could be at any stage we might die. And I saw this program about, you know, one of those Australian stories, this guy who was a multi-business, you know, entrepreneur and so forth, made a lot of money. And then he had some health scare, it was his heart. Anyway, he completely changed his life. He dropped the whole, you know, sort of multi-million dollar business, because he couldn't do it anymore. And he became an environmental activist. And he became very aware of how precious his life was, because again, he'd had this scare of death. He had experienced death, you know, near death or whatever. But he had that scare enough to realize, what am I doing with my life? You know, how am I making benefit of my life? And so he gave it up, became an environmental activist. And then they've got this clip of him where he's cycling, and then he gets off the bicycle, lies on the ground, and goes, one heartbeat away from death. So he's got it conscious in his mind the whole time that we are all one heartbeat away from death. So, you know, they say live each day like it's your last. Literally, if we did that, we'd think, okay, what am I going to do? So we've always got it in our conscious mind, which means we're always thinking about, is what I'm saying, is what I'm doing going to be a benefit? You know, or is it just blah, blah, blah? Or is it even critical, negative to myself, towards others, harmful? So being, it brings into our awareness by keeping death in mind, you know, and then we're creating positive karma for more and more virtue, more and more positive karma. So those seeds ripen more and more, become more and more familiar with us. And then it makes our spiritual practice very powerful by doing that. You know, it just becomes in our nature to be like that. And more assurance that you will die in a happy, peaceful state. I can't tell you how many long-term Buddhist practitioners have said to me, you know, okay, they lived, but they were in a car crash or something, and the amount of time that it took them to think about doing a spiritual practice. I know myself, when I ended up in hospital with pneumonia, and you know, I was in the poor me's for a while. It took me a good 12 hours to, at least, to think, perhaps I could ring, you know, one of my teachers and say, what practices should I be doing right now? I finally got around to it, but it was like 12 hours later, you know. So trying to think that at the time of death I'm going to have this instantaneous arising of, you know, a Buddha image or a practice or a mantra or anything like that is, unless I familiarize now constantly again and again, it's not just going to happen like that. And I've got the proof, because there I was, it was only a few years ago, 12 hours. I could have been dead in the meantime. I wasn't, but, you know, could be. And then, of course, by not doing that, by not reminding ourselves of death, familiarizing ourselves with, you know, the processes of death and so forth, we're not going to remember the Dharma. Our practice will not be persistent. So we won't have this urgency, you know, that, oh, I better practice now and keep my mind in virtue now, because what happens is... also, one of our teachers, she had a death scare a couple of years ago, and it was like, is my will in order? Have I tied up all my things? Have I left things so that people have to clean up after me? Like this guy, this friend of mine, it was just like his wife had to clean up all the mess, everything, and it's just like keeping our things in order, because we don't know, you know, when it's going to be. It's like you might have a surprise visitor, and that surprise visitor may or may not be death, you know. But it may be not death, but, you know, just keeping our lives in order. And that way, also, we won't have regrets at the time of death. Oh, I wish I had practiced sooner. Oh, I wish I had gone on that retreat, or whatever. You know, we feel like, okay, I've done the best that I can with this life. And I think if we could all feel like that, it would be amazing. Practice would be amazing. So then it all does come down to this sense of what is the role of karma in our life, So it talked about the karma of we when we leave this body and then we go into our next birth. That's the one form of karma, which is the throwing karma, which determines your lifespan pretty much, and this, you can either have it shortened or extended. But then you have the karma that is creating the results similar to the cause, so that as I mentioned, you know, the karma of killing is that you create the cause to be killed. And then there are the ones of immediate killing, so immediate retribution. You kill your father, your mother, an arahant, you draw blood from a Buddha. Again, I'm reminded of another guy in prison. It's the only place I meet people who admit to murdering people. And anyway, so he had killed his girlfriend. So it wasn't a father or mother, but it was someone close to him. He had killed his girlfriend, and it was so horrible an experience for himself, so torturous for his mind, that he said, and he lifted up his t-shirt and said, "This is what I did to myself." And he had a deep cut from here to here, was all stitched up. He was on the suicide watch unit. He just couldn't get over it, the torment in his mind. So if we say karmically, you kill your father, your mother, you'll have immediate retribution. And we can see how that operates even at the level of the law. You know, this guy who killed his relatives, his five relatives. So you can see the law is going to deal with him. But I just, immediately I heard that, I thought, his mind must be in torture. You know, from that moment on, they said he did it out of greed and hatred. And you just think, I bet you that action did not make his mind any calmer. You know, it would have made it worse. So immediately you could see that result. And then, not to mention what would happen in the next life, if you didn't purify, if you didn't say, okay, I regret all these actions, I wish never to do that again, I wish only to do positive actions and so forth. We have this capacity to purify. It's not like it's all fixed and you have nothing you can do about your karma. The practice is to get rid of the roots of that karmic seed. So the karma of creating the result similar to the cause in our experience. Oh, the result. You will be killed. Or you will have a shortened life, or you will suffer illness, chronic illness. It's like this friend of mine, she can't get out of bed, virtually so ill. And she goes, "What was my karma? What did I do in a previous life?" And I'm not a Buddha, I don't know. But all I can say is what I'm told is that if you suffer illness in this life, which we all do, we've all got a body, that they say it's a blessing of the Buddhas. Because it's better in this life than suffering for eons in hotels or different other... I mean, even animals. Look at how when animals get sick and they haven't got a human mind to go, "Oh, now I've got a cold and I'll get over it." And they're miserable. They're totally miserable. Whereas we can be miserable, but we know it's not going to last forever. You know, we know that we are going to improve or there's going to be treatment or this or that, so we can make some sense of it. But it also enables us to develop compassion for everyone else who has that condition. You know, the first time I ever fell over on my back and really injured my back, I only ever did it once. And so I have immediate compassion for everybody. Now let's stop the hurting. It wasn't quite a pure aspiration, but I did at least think about that other people have this experience, and now I know what it feels like. So through that, we can have empathy for others. So it enables us. It enables us to think of others. And particularly if you end up in hospital, you don't have to think about the suffering of others. You're right there and they're suffering. And when I was there with Milan, I thought, I'm only here first time as an adult, you know, aged 50, whatever. First time as an adult, pretty good track record. And these people have been in and out of hospital all the time. They're probably going to continue to be because they have chronic respiratory problems. So you know, using that as a benefit for your own practice. And so then you have the karma of the environment that you're born into. So I talked about how Australia, where they're born into, at least living here, Australia, and this part of Australia, we're on the east coast, like 80% of the population is on the coast, so we're in very good conditions. This is not the karma of people who've killed. Because if you'd killed, you'd be born in a place where people are killed. So, living in war zones and so forth, you wouldn't be able to escape that. Or having diseases where people die at a young age. You know, Aboriginal men in Moree had a life expectancy of 37 years. It's not very long, is it? That's the average life expectancy. So, the karma of that. Let alone being born as an animal that has a very short lifespan. You can think about what karmic results are created by the actions that we do. And even though perhaps, like me, you may not be able to remember past lives, I know what I've done in this life. And I know which bit of my life I prefer over the other. This bit's better than that bit. This bit there, that was good. Okay, so purifying what I can in this life to ensure that those karmic seeds are not going to ripen, the negative ones, positive ones, great, love them, and doing them more to create more and more positive so that we'll be in a good environment, meet with the Dharma as swiftly as possible, and so forth, continue on. So, mainly having no regrets at the time of death. So any amends or anything we've got to say, you know, on the people on their deathbed, it's always in the movies anyway, all the big confessions come on the deathbed, and you think, you've lived with this torture for years of your life, you haven't talked after your family, and suddenly on your deathbed you go, sorry. It's not too late really, because as long as you've cleared the deck for yourself, you've got a good chance. It's probably not the best way to live your life, and especially you don't know you're going to die, so best to clear up any of those debts or apology or whatever needs to happen as quickly as possible. But you can do that straight away, as quickly as possible, so it's not hanging over us. The little lies that then become big lies that can become a whole tragedy. So, okay, cut it off as soon as possible. And then that way we're only creating positive actions, we're not creating negative actions, unwise negative actions. Any other comments, questions? Okay. Yes.
There won't be rebirth, right? So what happens to the mind?
It depends. You see, there won't be rebirth. That depends. See, in the Mahayana tradition, so in the Theravadan tradition, Hinayana tradition, so the intent is for own personal liberation. The motivation is for personal liberation. In Mahayana tradition, the motivation is for enlightenment, to become a Buddha in order to then benefit others. You did say enlightenment, didn't you? Enlightenment. Nirvana. There's this nirvana with remainder and there's different nirvana. So the idea is that once you attain a state beyond the necessity to have a rebirth. So you don't necessarily have to take a body, you're beyond that. So that your mind, so it's like non-conceptual mind, so there's no dualistic object, subject, it's a sense of unity, it's a unity of calm abiding and special insight, and wisdom and clear light mind. which pervades everything. But in the Mahayana tradition, and in my tradition, the Vajrayana tradition, which is part of Mahayana, you, because along the path towards that, you make a wish. Like I say a prayer every day, a bodhicitta prayer, of a bodhisattva, to say, my purpose in attaining enlightenment is in order to benefit others. So that's my purpose. It's not to dwell in to dwell in nirvana without any further action. As long as there are beings that are suffering, so I can only talk truly from my own tradition. As long as there are beings who are suffering, the determination is to always come and help beings to attain that state themselves. So, in the Tibetan tradition, the Dalai Lama is regarded as the Buddha, Chenrezig, Avalokiteshvara, Buddha of great compassion. Every Dalai Lama has been regarded as that by Tibetans. And so, you would say that mind would not need to take human form, especially get sick and have colds. He just had a cold. Kept him in Japan. I thought, great, because now he can do all these practices in Japan. He certainly need it right now. Who knows what he was doing, but he was sick, so, and then went to America. So, but you could, from a Tibetan perspective, say he has taken human form to help others. And if we look at the world today and see that, regardless of religion, people are drawn to the Dalai Lama, regardless of Buddhist, non-Buddhist, whatever tradition, people are drawn to the Dalai Lama. Because we were just talking about that today in my workplace at Vajrayana Institute. So one of my work colleagues has just come back. She lives, her parents are in Sweden, and she's come back from Sweden. The Dalai Lama was talking there, and someone said, but there aren't many Buddhists in Sweden. They don't like Buddhism in Sweden. She said, no, they're very materialistic, but they like the Dalai Lama. They're not Buddhist, but they like the Dalai Lama. So we say having that capacity. And what does the Dalai Lama talk about? Peace, harmony, love, these things. So someone who can have an influence in the world like that, it doesn't have to be just the Dalai Lama, many other beings who have that capacity. So what my tradition would say, you don't just abide in the Nirvana, you do abide in the Nirvana. But at the same time, it's what Shakyamuni Buddha did. Descended to Tishu to heaven to teach his mom. And then they just go wherever you're needed. And yesterday I was at Nantian Temple in Wollongong. Have anyone been down there? Nantian in Wollongong? Gorgeous. Beautiful. Anyway, so I went there and they have an image of in the photo. Siddhagaba. Siddhagaba is a bodhisattva who made a determination to always free beings from hell realms. So you either decide a hell realm is a state of mind or it's an actual place. Mostly, I think we regard like states of mind. And so his vow was to always take form in that realm, to be able to help beings get out of the hells, because how do they get out of the hells? So there are many Buddhists have made different vows for many different purposes. So you have the different, like you have the solitude realizers, who are the beings that when there's no teachings of the Buddha, like, so I said how fortunate we are, we live in a place where there's Buddha's teachings, it's accessible, we're interested, and so forth. Solitary realizer is a being who, even when the Buddha's teachings aren't there, are able to realize teachings of the Buddha, even when there's not a Buddha around. Solitary realizer, and then the hearer realizers are the ones who hear the teachings of the Buddha. And then that state of nirvana.
Question.
not, it's complex. Yeah. It feels like that, doesn't it? Generally they say that the karmic seeds we sow in this life ripen in future lives. But, you know, I just look at my own life and think, I've got evidence that, you know, in my own life that it appears to me in my deluded way and uninformed way that the karmic seeds are ripened in this life. They say the ones that do are telling your mother, your father, an arhat, drawing blood from a Buddha. And they say you can't kill a Buddha, that's why it says drawing blood from a Buddha. And splitting the sangha, turning one sangha against another sangha, or, you know, causing conflict. So they're the things that they say you'll experience immediate karmic result from that. And that your next life, your immediate next life will be in the hell realms. And that there's nothing that you'll do to prevent that. That's what they say. But it does feel often like, and I think it is cause and effect. It's a natural law of cause and effect. You do positive result. You do negative result. It's not a moral judgment. It's not a guilt thing. It's just like a scientific law. This is fact. Yeah. But they do say it could ripen next life or in any future lifetime. And the importance of that is, say you've done something negative and you haven't purified it. So purifying it is like you'll practice to, like, you're expressing regret, saying, not saying, oh, poor, you know, I'm a terrible person. You're just saying, okay, yep, I stuffed up. Now what can I do about it? And you take refuge, you know, you admit it, you know, you confess it, you take refuge, you make a resolution not to do it again, and to, you know, sort of live according to your vows or whatever, so forth. The basic teaching of the Buddha, all distills to subdue your mind, do no harm. So you make a commitment, you know, now, not do this again. And some of the guys, one of the guys in prison that I visited, and he was like, he would do this practice every night, because I said, at least if you do it before you go to bed, you can guarantee for however many hours you sleep, you're not going to say anything to harm anybody and you're not going to do anything to harm anybody. And he thought that was fantastic, because the rest of his day was pretty challenging. You know, he'd get up in the morning and do his meditation. He'd say, it was all feeling really good, and then my soulmate really pissed me off. And then I got angry. And I said, well, at least for that 5 minutes and whatever time you spent sleeping, you did no harm. That's great. Rejoice in that. Fantastic. So, anyway, so yeah. So they do say it's future lives, but if we don't purify it, all karma expands. So negative karma, positive karma, all expands. All the more reason to create positive karma, because it just keeps growing and growing of its own accord. So all karma we will experience the result of. So if it's negative karma, it doesn't ripen in the next life, and it ripens in some future life, the longer that time is, the more heavy it becomes. So you really want to purify it in this life so it doesn't happen. But should you miss it, and it's going to happen, you want to. I would want it to ripen pretty quickly rather than take longer. There was one of our lamas who had a throat, tickle in his throat, constant cough. And he said that was because he had swallowed a mosquito. He hadn't meant to swallow the mosquito, but he had swallowed a mosquito in a previous life. And so, consequently, in this life, he couldn't get rid of his cough. Not such a bad thing to have to endure a cough, but yeah, it's terribly inconvenient when you're going to teach people. So, anyway, so all sorts of things like that. But we can, I think, that experience that you have of it feeling like you can see the result of it makes it make sense to us, doesn't it? Because otherwise we're just going on faith, belief, whatever, Buddha always said, check everything out, don't take everything I say as granted. You know, you make it make sense for yourself. So if you can see, well, like, for example, if you are around somebody who makes you feel good, and I'm not talking someone you've got a crush on, feeling love with or stuff like that, but just, it's a feel good, they're feel good people you like to be around, it's because they've practiced virtue, they've practiced it, and there's a good feeling about them, they're good people, you know, and it's from practice, it's from everything is from familiarity, so all our karma is from familiarity. And if that familiarity hasn't come in this lifetime, it's come in previous lifetimes. This is how things like child prodigies, you know, Mozart, have on earth at how few years of age. He did, had a short life, didn't he? So he had some mixed karma. He didn't last very long. But while he did, it made a huge impact. And from a very early age, he had a huge talent. And he could compose and this and that. So from a Buddhist perspective, you'd say, why, how come? Because he had practiced in previous lives, so he came into life with those talents. So even in the same family, all my brothers are really good at IT, computers, all of that, neon. So we had the same upbringing, we had the same parents, the same genes, same DNA, or similar DNA, it's not exactly the same, is it? But everything else contributing. And same opportunities at school and so forth, you know. But their tendencies are in that direction, mine are in a different direction. So this would say, this is our individual mind. So we got the bodies from our parents, but our minds we brought ourselves from previous lives. And so whatever you find that you're naturally good at, you think that's because you practiced it in the previous life. And that's why in this life you might want to develop a few more skills that you're naturally good at. Being naturally good at anger is not really a don't want to hang that shingle up, you know. And even the Dalai Lama, he wrote a book called Healing Anger because he said he had to deal with anger in his own mind in this life. He could feel the anger arising in his mind and he had to deal with that. And then 2007, when Dalai Lama was here in Australia, Kerry O'Brien interviewed him on 7:30 Report and said, you know, don't you get angry about the situation in Tibet, you know, with China, Tibet, blah, 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 blah. And the Dalai Lama said, I watched the anger arise in my mind and I watch it fade away. He wasn't saying, I get angry. He was saying, here I am watching my mind. The anger comes, the anger fades away. 1 minute. So this is 1 minute of his mind angry. And he said, the reason I can just simply watch it arise and fade away, and there's only one. Because since I was 6 years old, I practiced meditating on the karma body meditation. So that's in this life. And you say, oh, well, too late for me. But it's not too late for us. But so he set himself this challenge, you know, I've got to deal with these arising in my mind and to reduce their anger. And then he wrote about it to help other people, you know, meditation on healing anger. We all have that capacity. I've been talking about these people in prison. There was one woman who was put into prison for murder. And she didn't murder the person. And when she went into prison, she didn't have a particular religion or anything, but she went into prison and she said, I can see this as a prison cell, or I can see it as a meditation room. And so she spent the next 17 years meditating. And when they finally overturned and realised, you know, overturned the decision, they went through all the appeals and everything else, got overturned 17 years later. Not a skerrick of anger in her mind. No anger, no, you know, you've wasted 17 years of my life and blah, blah, blah. She's very calm mind, very lovely, lovely person. So she used what you could rightfully say was an unjust situation. It wasn't an unjust situation. She could use that to grow and grow anger and resentment, but she decided not to. Because who was that going to benefit? I mean, at the the very least you get ulcers, not some other worse enduring illness. It's not going to help her, it's not going to help others. And she decided, I won't go there. You know, for we have this power within our own mind to transform every situation, an opportunity for growth. Alrighty. Any other questions?
Something I'm quite interested in doing Venerable's background and then also journey to learn the Dharma.
Mm.
As in, because I think Venerable is Australian.
Yes.
So
yeah, I grew up a Catholic. Mm. Yes, I grew up in Newcastle. And yeah, I grew up Catholic, and I thought I was going to be a Catholic nun. I wanted to be a nun, you see. And this is the thing with my karma, would be when I spoke to Lama Zopa about it. He said, how long have you been thinking about being a nun? I said, since I was 5 years old. First of all, he misheard. He said, oh, for 5 years? I said, no, since I was 5 years old. And said, oh. And then he did his thing that he does, whatever. And then he said, oh, you've been a nun many of previous lifetimes. And I sort of thought, oh, that's great. But actually, it just simply makes sense. It simply made sense that why I, as a four-year-old, wanted to be a nun. I had no nuns in my family. I had no nuns, monks, religious, whatever is in my family. So it wasn't like I was born into the family trade or anything like that. Well, it was, but it wasn't it. And so it just makes sense, you know, that I had that wish, desire at a young age. And so I used to hang around with the nuns and I thought I was going to be a Catholic nun, but then I started to, when I was a teenager, move away from Catholicism. I was searching, but I just felt like it's not quite right. And you know what I was looking for, but it didn't quite fit for me. Actually, there was nothing wrong with it. It was just probably, you know, as the Buddha said, 84,000 paths. Whatever's going to help you along your spiritual path in this life, go for it. You know, pick that. And stick with it. The Dalai Lama says, you know, if you're Muslim, be a good Muslim. Catholic, be a good Catholic. Buddhist, be a good Buddhist. Don't change your religion, necessarily. You're not saying don't, but don't just change your religion. Because you've already got a good foundation, don't change it just because you think this one's going to be better. But anyway, I did. But it was after a lot of searching, very different, you know, I looked at Sufi, Hindu, various traditions, and even different traditions of Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, I think was the first I was aware of. And more it just came that I just kept going back to the same place. So in the end it was felt like it was decided for me. The same place was Vajrayana Institute. I just kept going back and back and back, and I was just saying, I think your decision's made. I think you don't have to make a decision here. And it was like it made most sense to me, and I think mostly around this question of karma, because for me no other religion explains a whole lot of this stuff, you know, that is explained in Buddhism. How is it that we have these deja vu experiences? How is it that we're familiar, we're good at some things and not good at others? How is it that all these things come about? And the idea of karma makes most sense to me. So in any case, yeah, so that's where I ended up, and then the more and more I came along, I'd forgotten that I wanted to be a Catholic nun. Actually, I forgot about being a nun altogether. I had a wild time in my 20s. But then I just, you know, that same thing awoke. Actually, it started when I was at university when I met the lamas, and I really wanted to go and do that, but I didn't know anything about Buddhism and I didn't inquire at that point. And so it came along later. And then, you know, more and more I went along the path. For me, you know, being ordained Sangha has been the most beneficial thing I've done in my life. So and for myself, it's raised a lot more opportunities and ways. And it's not for everybody, obviously. You've got to have somebody's got to have the babies. No, but they, I mean, with the advice of the lamas and what, you know, Lama Zogchen chose told many people, no, not this lifetime, not monk or nun this lifetime, and then they end up, you know, having a wonderful family and they're all connected and they're done and, you know, these other plans. So we all have our spiritual path that is going to bring out the most benefit for us. I guess it's for each of us finding that and being guided. You know, I'm constantly reminded about following the Guru's advice, following the Lama's advice, because they know, because they do have, like the Buddha, that clairvoyance to know what's going to be most beneficial to you. There's many, like with one example, this guy in, he went to see Lama Zofa, and you know, we have these practices of doing 100,000 prostrations and 100,000 mandala offerings, 100,000 this and 100,000 that and whatever. The 100,000 is not necessarily a magic number. It's enough to have that develop within our mind stream, so that it's always present in our mind. So you do 100,000 refuge prayer, you're going to wake up saying refuge prayer. It's just going to be there like that. And apparently sports science has done this too. They say if somebody does something 100,000 times, they'll just have it naturally. So science is caught up with Buddha. Anyway, so this guy wanted to do these prostrations, and he went to see Lama Zogchen to get his permission, and Lama said, actually, he gave him other advice, which is to make satsas, which are like plaster Buddha molds. They often have walls of all these Buddha images made of plaster and then painted in gold. Anyway, Lama Zogchen said to do that, and he's saying, and so he goes, yes, and the prostration. So they went through this about three times. In the end, Lama Zogchen said, okay, go and do your prostration. And he went and got a prostration board. This is that Bodh guy, you know, the Buddha was alive. When he got a prostration board, because many people do it there, it's a very powerful place. And so he went there. Before he even did one prostration, he fell flat on his back and broke his back. And he ended up in the monastery making this. So it was like Lama Zogchen was trying to prevent him from having the accident. And so he couldn't see the accident, but Lama Zogchen could see this was going to happen. So he tried to prevent it. But so the guy who this happened to, he's writing the story and saying, I should have listened, but I didn't listen, you know, and I just thought I knew better. So, you know, following the guidance, and it's sort of like, it's there for a reason, you know. It's like anything we learn, like learning at university, you know, follow the advice that's given. You know. People have done it before, they know the pitfalls. But we have our own independent minds and we want to do things out. Anyway, that's a long answer to a short question. So just in terms of life and death, how would you feel if you were to die right now? How would you manage it? Well, you know, I've been talking about it can happen right now. Do you think you'd cope right now? How would you cope? How would you handle it? What would you do? It's something to think about, isn't it? What would I do if I was to die right now? Oops, I'm going to be doing something. Anyone got any ideas, contemplations on that? Yes. Yeah. That's right. And that's part of the thing of when we die, we're not going to take those others with us. And how we practice letting go, if we were actually, I mean, hypothetically, but you know, if we were actually dying. we would have to let go of that attachment to worrying about things, because that will keep us bound to this life or between lives. That does happen too, because people are more attached to this life even though they've died, and so they're in an in-between state. And you know, from living this life, it sounds, and all the attachment to this life, it sounds terrible to say, oh, but I'd abandon them and I wouldn't care for them. But it's like, it's not you of this life that's going to go into another life, like this mind is going to, but the you of this life will cease to exist, and that would concern me. The other thing to know is that we have very strong karmic connection, our strongest karmic connections with our mother or our father, someone who's played that role in our life. So we have met previously, we'll meet again. And so we've all been, coming up from Mother's Day, we've all been each other's mother. All beings have been our mothers many times, again and again and again. So we celebrate Mother's Day. Suddenly there's a whole lot of mothers that you never knew you had. So all of them. No, it's true. It's a precious thing. You know, the precious thing of celebrating the mother of this life, or the person who's played that role, and all the kindness they've shown us in this life is quite remarkable. And those of you who are mothers might know that in terms of your own children, there's an unconditional love, an endless unconditional love. So Sunday is a very good opportunity to repay the kindness to all the kind mother sentient beings. I hope you have the opportunity to do that, and to thank them for giving you a life. So anyone else want to hazard how you would be if you were to die right now? How would you handle it? What thoughts arise?
Lately I've been complaining more, but it's not that death is going to come anyway, or certain. That's how I feel, but when I contemplate it, I feel a sense of certainty that practice is really important.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's not practicing now, who knows I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And also by contemplating that, I also appreciate what I've got now, and I appreciate people.
Yes.
And I tend not to fall pregnant as I used to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it does make our life more rich and
yeah.
positive now.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good thing to do. I mean, it sounds morbid, but it's actually a really good thing to do. I mean, value more what you have right now. It's very perfect. Yeah. Good. Anyone else? In many traditions, there are very many different mantras associated with different Buddhas. Like mantra for Shakyamuni Buddha, for Chenrezig Devalokeshvara, Manjushri Buddha, any mantra. So they're called different things in different traditions. The Buddha of Wisdom, Amitabha, Buddha of Long Life, or Amitaya, Long Life. Again, in my tradition, Tara, that's a popular one, green Tara, white Tara, something like many, many different mantras, which are a collection of sounds that set up like a positive vibration, and repeat over and over again to have that, like this compassion or whatever, to have that in your mind, just sort of arising naturally in your mind. And so if you have a particular centre or somewhere where you go to or whatever, it's generally how you learn a mantra, depending on whatever tradition you're in, because it's slightly different. They're usually Sanskrit, but I know like you might learn it in Chinese or you might learn it in Sanskrit or you might learn it in Pali. Very healing effect, and it mantra, the word mantra means a protection for the mind. So I like to think, well, if I'm wanting to put my mind in a positive state, if I'm reciting mantra, because you can't have two thoughts simultaneously, they can come quickly on each other, not simultaneously. So if I'm reciting mantra, I can't be having a negative thought at the same time. I think that's fantastic. And so, you know, just think, okay, I'll just recite mantra a lot. Yeah, generally. Do you have another center or somewhere that you go to? Or do you have a Buddhist center apart from coming here that you go to?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
Not yet, anyway.
Not yet, anyway. Keep hanging around, you'll pick up a few mantras along the way.
I think the closest I've been to having a mantra is going to the gym and my footsteps.
Yeah.
Or
anything can be mantra.
Yeah. Or meditating and imaging colors in my head. Yellow, red, orange.
Yeah.
Probably the first one then.
So the very simplest one is Om, and that's sort of in Hinduism and Buddhism, sort of Om, which is a collapsing of Om, Ah, Om. And that's the pure Om is the pure body of a Buddha. Ah is the pure speech of the Buddha. And Hum is the pure mind of the Buddha. So it's just saying Om, the Omahu, Om. It's like calling to mind, pure body, speech, and mind of the Buddha. So it's sort of everything, all in one. And so when you're going on, on actually pedaling at the gym. That's very good. Okay. Anything else? Mm-hmm. We've covered quite a bit of ground tonight. So I hope it's been beneficial for everybody, and wish you all the best on your spiritual path and on your educational path as well, your academic path. No doubt you're both are intertwined. Okay, so maybe we dedicate all the positive merits or the just being together here. And you say karmically we have been together previously many times in different lives. So all the merit, all the positive energy that we've created together, may it be of benefit to ourselves and to all those we encounter. May all beings live in peace. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings experience every joy, everything their hearts desire. May I be responsible for this by myself alone. Thank you.